welcome back to episode 2 of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and you can find us at musicjobspodcast.com. That's jobs with an S. We are also on all the streaming platforms. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android. If you go to the website, you'll be able to find links for all that. So I hope that you will please subscribe and share and tell your friends. Last week was episode 1. I hope you got a chance to catch it. It was with Marvin V. Acuna. If you didn't get a chance to listen to it, go on back and listen to it. It's a really great interview. He is partner and manager of Chloe Temchin Entertainment, who is an incredible singer-songwriter, and he's also executive producer and co-creator of Platinum Hit on Bravo, a reality competition series about singing and songwriting. So obviously great insight. He's an incredible marketer and shared all about how to tell a story, how to craft a story, how to pitch a story, your story as an artist. So a really great interview. Today's interview is no exception to amazing, if I do say so myself. It's with Colin Wolfe. He's not exactly a household name, but he is one of those icons in the industry who is well known and deeply respected by those who are in the know, if you know what I mean. So if you know Colin Wolfe, you must be somebody. Colin worked with Dr. Dre on The Chronic, the album that essentially changed everything. Tony Best for Wax Poetics described it best, I think. He said, Wolfe revolutionized the sound of hardcore hip-hop with Dr. Dre. His bass and synth-laden grooves infused The Chronic with a level of sophistication never before heard in gangster rap. But Dre and N.W.A., and other incredible artists that Colin worked with was just the beginning. Throughout his career, he's worked with, you know, little-known groups like TLC and Boyz II Men. He's worked with Madonna, Michael Jackson, George Clinton, Bjork, and Aretha Franklin. I'd say this man gets around, and he never stops working. Colin let me in on a little sneak peek of a new track that he's working on with the University of North Carolina School for the Arts. He went out there just to do a speaking engagement, and it basically turned into an incredible multi-collaboration with all the students at the School for the Arts. On this track, we're getting an amazing sneak peek of it before it's released. It sounds like the entire state of North Carolina is going to be involved in this project with video and more songs being written. So again, I don't know how this man sleeps, but here's a little clip, little sneak peek of this track called Sun.
I wanna take care of you. Every little step you take, I float away, away. I'll be back someday.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you for joining me on my Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job podcast.
That's a step.
Yeah. So I want you to tell me, like, what kind of household did you grow up in terms of, we don't have to get all, like, psychological, but just in terms of music, right? Just in terms of music, what kind of you remember listening, your parents were listening to when you were growing up, that kind of thing?
Okay, it's a crazy story. How it all really, really started was when I was about 3 years old, I was living in Santa Barbara, and my blind twin cousins, Dennis and Darlene, used to babysit me and my brother, and they were musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And they would teach my brother stuff or try to teach him stuff, like on the piano or whatever. And after a while, you know, they wouldn't really pick it up. They would get up, and I would set myself on the piano and teach myself what they were trying to teach him. So that was kind of the beginnings of it. And then their brothers, my other cousins, introduced me to other groups like Isley Brothers, the Jackson 5, Parliament Funkadelic, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I would say, the beginnings, but that's, you know, 3-4 years old.
So you were playing the piano at 3 or 4 years old?
Yeah, teaching myself things here and there. And then by like 5 and 6, or, you know, whatever instruments I was around, I was able to just pick up and just kind of play. So drums, I think, was next. And then probably like guitar, trumpet during like elementary, and then finally bass in the 6th grade. And I started playing bass because I was the president of my elementary school, Baldwin Hills Elementary. So I had my friends, and invited my friends to come play during lunchtime at during Halloween. So for some reason, they asked me to play bass on Day Tripper, even though I didn't play bass. So I learned that song, and from that point on, kept playing bass. And I think 2 years after that, I started doing professional gigs already. Was doing like musical plays and stuff like that at a place called Inner City Cultural Center. That was like right off of like Pequim, Vermont. It was a summer program, and that was the beginnings of it.
Wow.
Kept going from there, yeah.
So no formal lessons. It was literally like, hey, you know, figure out how to play this bass line. Right?
Yeah, I mean, and then whatever you would do in school, you know what I mean, like orchestra and all that kind of stuff. But that was it, you know, for the students.
Were you just, you know, were you like Prince, like you looked through the phone book to see if there was any other job you'd want? You were like, no, this is it. Like, was music it from day one?
Yeah, was it? I mean, because at like age 12 or 13, I was starting to buy my own school clothes. So I was making my own money.
Nice. So, and this is what, through just selling music? Like, how are you, or doing gigs,
no,
or all
playing,
the above?
Playing in the musical plays at that place called the Inner City Culture Center. Like, so I was getting paid for that.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, so that was a summer program, so I got paid the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point on, you know, I started buying my own school clothes. And then I recognized that from that point on, every summer, my gigs start getting better and better. You know,
nice.
I start getting better gigs and getting more pay and this and that. So,
and were you just practicing all the time, or was it more just kind of like you'd rehearse when you had a gig, or like how did, what was that? Like, did you spend every free moment you could playing, or like how did that?
The free moments I did have, I would sit in my room and either play along to the radio, or like learn like some Stanley Clarke songs or Jaco Pastorius songs and stuff like that, or Louis Johnson or something. But a lot of times, just sitting there to the radio, whatever song came on, you know, by the time they got to the second verse, I'm playing right with them.
Wow, that's great. So you did this through your teens, yeah? And it just kept getting bigger and bigger?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then did you reach sort of a fork in the road where you were like, I could go this way, or I could go this way, or what kind of happened?
Well, no. Well, I did start going to UCLA. I was getting ready to declare my major, which was going to be a biochem major.
Wow. And why? Then, biochem? Just you were like,
those,
I like, I like biochem.
My favorite subject. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's so
that's
cool.
What I like.
Nice.
That's what I like. So I think after a year, someone hired me to play bass for them at this place called the China Club in Hollywood back in the day. And I'm doing a bass solo, and while I'm doing the bass solo, in through these big double doors comes like Eazy-E and Jerry Heller and Dr. Dre, the whole Ruthless camp was walking in right when I was doing the bass solo. And they were looking for a bass player to go on tour with Miss Chalet at the time.
Wow.
So
that's timing, man. That's like,
I know.
That's crazy timing. Wow.
Yeah.
So that was it. You were like, boom, done.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we went on tour and didn't go back to college.
Wow. How long were you in college for? Like,
About a year and a half.
Nice. Hey, yeah. That's all you need. It's like the NBA or something.
Yeah.
Nice.
Exactly,
so
right.
You went on tour, and what was that like? Was that like a total mind fuck? Were you like, holy shit, this is like nothing I've ever experienced? Or what was that like?
I don't know. Yeah, no. I mean, like, you know, I have been doing those musical plays, so I've been playing in theaters in front of hundreds of people already. So we went to Japan. That was the first place we went to. So that was kind of a mind fuck, but for the most part, not so much. Like, I was kind of ready for it, you know? I had been preparing for those moments already the whole time, so.
Wow.
It was, I guess, more of a mindfuck just traveling that far away, like traveling to Japan. you know, at that young of age. Like, nobody does that, you know?
Right.
But as far as getting up on stage and rocking out, like, you know, that was nothing, really.
Yeah. Did you feel like you did you have a mentor? Or did you feel like you needed a mentor? Or were you just kind of like, you felt like you had sort of fully formed at that point? You were just like, I can roll with this. I can roll with whatever.
Yeah. I mean, as far as the live part was going, you know, that was one thing. But then I started getting close with Dre at that time and started hanging out with him in the studio. So then I would say he was my mentor for the studio. Mm-hmm. So I started learning that whole part of it, that whole side of it, the production side of it.
Right.
Which is a whole nother thing than, you know, just live performances.
Right, exactly. Do you feel like he taught you a lot about the business?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we would talk about it a little bit, but mostly we're just in the studio just grinding. So I was there from like the beginning to the end of a, you know, like the Niggas for Life album. Mm-hmm. I was there from the very beginning to the end. So I just saw how the whole process went down. You know?
Right. Now, did you ever feel like I want to go out on my own, or you were just like, I'm going to just take this train as far as I can go? Or like, tell me if you can kind of walk me through how things kind of evolved from there.
The way I kind of went out on my own was when we started doing the Chronic album. You know, we hooked up with a bunch of other cats. One guy, you know, whose name we don't really need to mention, who's in jail right now, mm-hmm. been in jail for a little bit. When he first came in, he was cool. Everything was cool. Everybody got along. You know, everything was kosher. And then after the album was done, the Chronic album, and money started coming in, you could just see a change, you know, just things start getting crazy, a little street around there, and they're bringing street elements into the studio that didn't need to be. So,
right.
You know, I was like, okay, this is not cool. You know, I don't feel safe coming to the studio. Like, that's not cool.
Yeah.
So I had the opportunity to go to Atlanta to work with an artist, MC Breed. And it was that same record that MC Breed and Tupac was on, the Gotta Get Mine record, and that album. So I went to Atlanta with MC Breed and stayed out there for 7 years. And while I was out there, after finishing that MC Breed album, I hooked up with Dallas Austin and Roddy Records and that whole Camping Posse.
Mm-hmm.
So learned a whole nother style of production and songwriting through him as well.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Now, what about just in terms of the business? Like, what would you say, you know, just for folks out there listening, like, what are the things you got to keep your eye on that you got to, like, protect yourself? You got to, like, be smart about? What would you say?
The business is so different nowadays. I mean, back then, you know, people were doing publishing deals and a lot of people were having record deals and production deals. But nowadays, because of social media and the internet, some people don't necessarily need record labels anymore. Because really what you would use them for would be like for marketing and production and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, they're outsourcing people to do marketing production themselves. So you can do the same thing with them.
Right, right. Just hire them for distribution or something like that.
Yeah.
So did you feel like I need a manager or I can just do this myself? I need an agent. I need this. I need that. Like, or were you kind of like, you know, you were already in a whole group kind of thing, so you didn't have to worry about that? You just showed up?
Right. I was with different camps. I was with the whole Rowdy camp, so I was fortunate enough to be able to hook up with them. So, yeah, I didn't necessarily need that. But, I mean, for some people, it definitely does help, especially for artists. You know, they kind of need that guidance sometimes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
What about, do you feel like you got everything that was owed to you? You feel like, did you have to fight? Like, were there situations where you really had to like take a stand and be like, look, this, I'm part of this creative process, so I need to be compensated or I need to be credited or that kind of thing? Did that ever come up?
No, not really, because at the times when I was with these people, we were all, you know, on the uprise together. So mm-hmm. back then, everybody was pretty fair with everything.
Good.
And, you know, everybody was even with distributing everything back then. I mean, I think it's a little different now. Everybody's just trying to get in where they fit in nowadays, but I was fortunate enough to be able to hook up with some good people, a good, honest people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they gave me what was due. And, you know, so I didn't have to fight that much for it. Some instances, yeah, but I had a publishing deal, so they were able to collect all that stuff for me, so.
Good, so you didn't have to deal with it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah.
What happened after Atlanta?
After Atlanta, Atlanta, from 92 to 99, Atlanta was popping. You got to remember, TLC came out, ABC, Usher, Outkast, Goody Mob, Tony Braxton, The Brat, Chris Cross.
Yeah.
So Atlanta was popping back then. And that's where the whole momentum in the whole industry was in Atlanta at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So after about 98, 99, the momentum died and it kind of just dispersed everywhere. It wasn't really in no one particular place. So I came back to L.A., back to the West Coast.
And then what did you do once you got back to L.A.? Where'd you pick up?
I started continuing doing production and then also ventured off in commercial world and TV and film world as well. And I've been doing that basically ever since I got back as well with a company called Beacon Street Studios, which is in Venice. So I still do production and I do that as well. So a little bit of everything.
You want to talk about that a little bit just for people, how you got it? I mean, you obviously had amazing connections, but you know, like what was that switch like? Like what is that side of the business like, TV and film and syncing and all that stuff?
Well, back then, when I first got into it, it was kind of still fresh and new.
Uh-huh.
And there weren't a lot of library houses, is what we call them nowadays, back then.
Mm-hmm.
So I got it with a company that was just starting out. And we used to go out and meet with the agencies and this and that. And we just start building it and just start pitching ideas for different spots and becoming friends with the different people at the agencies, invite them out to the studio, take them out to dinner. So we actually became friends with a lot of them. So they would come out and they would come to the studio and hang out with us, and they would, you know, give us whatever jobs that they had. So after doing that for a while and being successful at a lot of them, we built a lot of relationships with a lot of different agencies. But nowadays, people are building libraries. Like, a lot of people are taking some of their tracks that haven't been used and just making their own libraries. So a lot of these agencies nowadays are just going to these library houses and just going through their libraries and picking the tracks. But we still get our calls because we still have great relationships with a lot of people at some of these big agencies. So we're still very fortunate enough to still be big in the game. But a lot of people are going to these library houses nowadays, too. Which is another great way for people who have an abundance of tracks. Just sitting there, you know.
Yeah.
It's a great way to get them out and get them used for something.
Right. So these are these your original compositions and you have like a stable of artists that you have to perform them, or how does that?
Well, we do have a bunch of different artists, but for the most part, a lot of these spots are instrumental. Only on some of them, they will require vocals.
But
a lot of them, are instrumentals. But we have basically like a Rolodex of artists that we would call, depending on the sound of the spot that they want it. You know, if we need a pop singer, a rock singer, a soul singer, whatever, we have different people to call for each category.
But you're writing the tracks, right? You're writing, producing the tracks?
Yeah, that also, but sometimes they'll have you either flip a song and they'll change the lyrics, you know what I mean? To accommodate their commercial, or sometimes we are writing the song and producing, which I like the most, you know, we can come up with original stuff, but sometimes they're just having you flip some old song. Maybe it could be some old Christmas song or whatever. They might have you flip some song or whatever.
Right.
Depending on the spot, you know, and time of year, of course.
Yeah. And do you feel like the business is blowing up with like Amazon and Netflix and all this? Is there still good money on the table, or is the market getting saturated, or what do you think?
It is getting saturated, but the money is also getting better because at first places weren't collecting these money, you know, from streaming and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily nowadays, that's getting better. We are seeing more income from streaming and stuff nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So we are fortunate there. And there are other various like publishing companies. Like, for instance, this is one company called PPL, which will collect your monies for you for overseas stuff,
mm-hmm.
like all the European markets and all that stuff. Like if your song is played on the radio out in London or wherever overseas, there's companies that will collect that for you as well.
Right. That's very cool. That's going to be really helpful. All right.
Oh,
Will you do me a favor?
Yep.
Will you talk about Michael Jackson for me?
Yeah, no doubt. So working with Michael Jackson was, that was an awesome experience. He had, I think, 4 or 5 whole studios locked out.
That's crazy.
And we're talking each studio probably had 3 or 4 rooms.
Wow.
And there's people working in each different room. And we happened to be working in the same one that he was working in, which mm-hmm. was a studio called Record One, which is off Ventura Boulevard. I think Dre owns that studio now. But mm-hmm. when I was there, we were working there with Michael, and we were in one room, and he'd be in the other room, and like we used to go all night. You know, we'd literally work all night, and Mike would be there all night too working.
Wow.
Like, he was there just as much as we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was in the kitchen, I think eating some sushi or something like that, and Mike used to love sushi. He would always eat salmon all the time. With a bunch of wasabi. And like I'd be sitting there in the kitchen and he'd be walking by, but he would stop and say hi to you, spoke to you, talk to you, see how you were doing. He wouldn't just keep walking by.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm Michael Jackson, big old sir, don't talk to me, don't touch me. Nah, he would sit there and talk to you and make sure, you know, everything's good with you.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very, you know, cool like that.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like he had a hell of a work ethic, too, because that's the thing. If he's putting in the time just like everybody else, you know?
Yeah, he was there nonstop. And, you know, when he would leave the studio that we were all at, shoot, he'd probably go to one of the other studios to go check on some of the mixes or something like that.
Wow. Yeah. He was, I believe he was like a hell of a micromanager, but obviously it paid off, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, do you want to talk about what you're working on now and what's coming down the pipe?
Yeah. So back in May, a friend of mine is a professor at University of North Carolina School of the Arts. So him and I have been talking for a couple of years just for me to come down and visit him. There was no mention of School of the Arts yet. So by the time it came down for me to actually make it out there, well, he was like, well, why don't you just come to the school and, you know, maybe you can sit down and talk to some of the students. So that kind of morphed into, okay, well, do a speaking. We have a theater downtown Winston-Salem. Why don't you do a speaking engagement there?
Wow.
I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the 25th year anniversary of the Chronic album.
Wow.
And they're like, well, can you talk about the Chronic album and, you know, kind of like how it was created and some of the songs and stuff. So I went there to the Stevens Theater is what it's called in Winston-Salem. I did a speaking engagement there, and then that following week, I did like a week with the students, like different various workshops, and so one day was a songwriting workshop, and I actually wrote a song with the kids.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, so then the song, my friend's wife sang it, and the song just came out great, and then we're getting artist support from behind it. So now we're going to get together with some of the students from all of the different schools at the School of the Arts, like the film school, the design school, the dance school, drama school, and we're going to make a video for this one song. And then Chapel Hill is going to help premiere it, and NC State wants to help premiere it as well, too.
Oh,
and NC State wants me to come out there and do some speaking engagement over at their university as well, too.
Nice.
So somehow, now we have the whole state kind of jumping behind this project.
Mm-hmm.
And we just went out there and just did 5 more songs. So now we have this project called Alley and the Giant. And the first song we're going to release is going to be a song called Sun.
S-U-N?
Yep.
Okay.
And we should be shooting the video in December. And we're supposed to premiere it in April. And so we're going to premiere it at the School of the Arts. at NC State, and I think at Chapel Hill as well. And I think UNC TV is getting behind the project as well, too.
That's great.
So literally, the whole state is really getting behind this project.
That's
and,
amazing.
And just showing the support.
So maybe if people just go to the, you know, the college website, the arts website section, they should be able to follow and be able to see the premiere and stuff, you think?
Yeah, definitely.
All right,
definitely. Cool.
Is there any final words of wisdom that you want to share to people that are trying to either break out as an artist or they're trying to get into the whole like syncing or library stuff? Like, do you have any final words you want to impart about that? I know that's like two different things, but.
Yeah, well, for one, as an artist, stay in your own lane and create your own lane. I do not chase what you hear on the radio or try to sound like anybody else. Like, as soon as you say, like, oh, I'm going to be the next Michael Jackson, then you're already done.
Yeah.
You have to be the next you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't be the next somebody else. You can never be the next somebody else.
Yeah.
You can only be the next you. And so many people fall short of that. They just don't know how to find their own voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's I would say my main thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like the commercials and sync stuff goes, that's a tricky business because a lot of those agencies, all they do is chase radio too.
Yeah.
They just want a song that sounds like some other hit song.
Right.
Very rarely do we find an agency that's cool and hip and just wants something dope. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
They always want something that sounds like something else. And sometimes that's just a hard road to go down sometimes because you can go back and forth, and it's never going to beat that song that they already fell in love with.
Yeah.
And the reason why they came to you, it's probably because they couldn't license it because the artist is probably going to charge them too much.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So then sometimes you'll be working on it, going down the road. A month, 2 months go down the line, and you're still going back and forth with demos. Then all of a sudden, oh, they liked the song, and now you're out.
Yeah.
You know, that happens. That happens a lot. So
yeah,
that whole, you know, commercial business, it's tricky.
It is tricky. Yeah. I went to like a conference, and they were like, they didn't say it outright, but they were basically like, yeah, we were looking for a cheap Taylor Swift. We're looking for a cheap Rihanna. We're looking for a cheap.
No, exactly.
You know what I mean? And you're like,
exactly.
Oh, fuck. Because that's exactly what you said about staying in your own lane. It's like hard if you get this, hey, if you just sound a little bit like Taylor Swift and we only have to pay you $5,000,
yep.
you know, versus a yep. $100,000,
exactly.
you know, it's tempting because it's sort of like, exactly. oh, just grab the money now, you know, but you're right. It's like, you're just going to hit a wall with it.
Yeah. I mean, you got to kind of have two different hats with that. You got to, you know, if that's one way you want to get up and make some money, that's cool and fine. But don't let that be what you're trying to do. I mean, you may have to stick around after hours to start to work on your own stuff.
Right.
And that's what I do. You know what I mean? I would work on commercials and stuff with these guys like during the day, but I'd be the only one there on the weekend working on my own stuff.
Nice.
Or even in the evening, I would stick around so I can continue working on my own stuff.
Yeah.
Because working on those commercial stuff is just not satisfying enough for me.
Right. It's creative. You got to like feed the creative beast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that's all I got. And you were amazing. And I'm really appreciative that you found the time because I know it's really busy and crazy for you right now. But thank you so much. And I think people are going to get a lot out of this.
You're welcome. That's what's up.
I'd say that's some pretty good stuff from Mr. Wolf. Wouldn't you agree? If you want to continue to follow this project that he's doing with the University of North Carolina School for the Arts, I'd go to their website, uncsa.edu, maybe follow them on Twitter to get premiere dates and things like that, because it just sounds like it's going to continue to be an amazing collaboration. Thanks again for listening. Please join us next week. We'll have another great guest from the music industry who will share insights, anecdotes, advice, suggestion, and what I think is some pretty powerful inspiration and motivation, which we all could use right now. Our website again is musicjobspodcast.com. That's jobs with an S. You can subscribe to all the streaming platforms on that website. So please subscribe, like, and share. Tell your friends. I am L Ariel, your host. My website with my music and all my other crap is lariel music.com. You can go on and check me out there. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So Hope to see you next week. And in the meantime, keep on hustling, pursue that dream, don't give up.